Penguin Random House Audio presents Perilous Times, a novel by Thomas D. Lee, read for you by Nicola F. Delgado.
For my high school English teacher, Mrs. Parker, because I said I would. Part 1. Chapter 1. Kay crawls up from under his hill, up through the claggy earth. For the last 1,000 years, the land around his hill has been dry. Drainage and farming and modern miracles kept the water away. He remembers. Now the ground is waterlogged, as it was when he was first buried, before the fens were drained. He starts to wonder why, but then he gets a worm in his eye, which is the sort of foul development that drives the thoughts from your head. He makes a small, disgusted sound and wipes the worm away. This part's always disagreeable. The brutes scramble up toward the daylight. He burrows through the clay, grabs at roots until the earth falls away and he's looking up at the vaguely yellow sky. He gets his head out first, and then an elbow, before taking a break to catch his breath. The air doesn't taste particularly good. The sun is baking down on his face. It must be midsummer. He has another go at getting free. The earth's pulling down on his legs, but the slippery mud slickens his chainmail and provides lubrication. Finally, there is an almighty squelch and he feels the earth let go. His leg comes free. His hips get past the roots. When he's out to his knees, he almost slips, falls back into the strange hollow that he's climbed out of, but he manages to stop himself. He gets his shins above ground, and then he's up, kneeling in the sun, panting in the heat, wearing a coat of mail and a green wool cloak, both rimed with muddy afterbirth. His dreadlocks are matted with earth. Sure enough, his little burial hill is surrounded by bog. The waters have risen. This is how it was when he was buried, before the trees grew from his stomach. He gulps down air, trying to fill his lungs, but the air feels heavier than it ought to feel. It doesn't look like there's anyone here to wake him up this time. In the old days, there were bands of horsemen, sometimes even a king in person, when the need was dire. Then it became army lorries or circles of druids in white shifts, slightly surprised that their dancing had actually achieved something. More recently, a man in a raincoat, checking his wristwatch, with a flying machine roaring on the grass behind him. Nothing today. It must be one of the more organic ones, where the earth itself decides to shake his shoulder. Something shifting in the spirit of the realm. Or, maybe, the birds in the sky have held a parliament and voted to dig him up. He looks around. No sign of any birds either. Bad then, he mutters to nobody. Kay drags himself to his feet. First thing to do is to find his sword and shield. They usually get regurgitated somewhere nearby, though there's no exact science to it. He's not sure that the Earth fully understands its obligations. The covenant with Merlin was fairly specific. Make this warrior whole again and surrender him back to the realm of the living whenever Britain is in peril. Return him with his sword and shield and other tools of war untarnished. When peril is bested, let him return to your bosom and sleep until peril calls him forth again. It couldn't have been much clearer, but mud is mud. Mud struggles with written instructions. There were bound to be some misunderstandings. There's something new across the bog. He squints at it, because the sun is bright and reflecting off the metal parts. An ugly cluster of low buildings with pipes running everywhere like a mass of serpents. In the centre is a silver tower shaped like a bullet. A fortress. Bigger, though, than Arthur's fortress at Caer Morlaeth ever was. Didn't used to be there, he says to himself. It seems like a good place to start, if he's going to figure out why he's back. He heads downhill, the earth squishing underfoot. His sword might be in the box somewhere, hilt protruding from the wet earth. Hopefully he'll just stumble onto it. That's usually how this works. The various ancient forces of the realm conspiring to make things easier for him. That was always one of the perks of being in Arthur's warband. You'd blunder into the forest, and you'd happen upon a talking raven who could tell you where to find what you were questing for. How else would idiots like Bors and Gawain have achieved anything if they hadn't had assistance from white hinds and river spirits guiding them on their way? Not that they ever showed any gratitude. Across the bog, the mess of buildings glistens. Strange that whoever built this thing built it so close to his old hill. But it's no stranger than white hinds or talking ravens. Riding through the old forests, you could never shake the feeling that there was a quest around the corner, put there by some greater power. Whether that power was the Christ King, or the Saxon gods, or some older goddess of the trees, Arthur never seemed to notice. It seemed natural to him that things of import should occur in his proximity. If anyone else noticed, they knew better than to mention it. Only Kay would bring it up occasionally and earn himself a scowl from Merlin or a jibe from Lancelot. There's a thought to make him angry. Lancelot on his white horse sneering, whispering in Arthur's ear, "Look, sire, a brown Nubian covered in brown filth, and no browner for it. It's a good thought for fueling you through a bog." He imagines Lancelot in the distance, goading him. He imagines pulling Lancelot down from his horse and punching him in the jaw, drowning him in the mud. That's a nice thought for getting you through a bog, too. The mud isn't so bad at first. He wades through it with barely a grimace. It's no worse than Agincourt or the Somme. At least there's no bullets flying, no hot shell fragments raining down, or French coursers charging at him. The only problem is the mail, which weighs him down. And Christ, it's a hot day. Summers never used to be this hot. He's sure of it. It's a day for resting in the shade, not wearing mail or wading. If it gets any thicker, he'll be right back underground again, slowly choking, lungs filling with mud. And what would happen then? He's died in 40 different ways over the years, from Saxon spearheads and Byzantine fire and Japanese inhospitality. But he's never drowned in mud before. That would be a new one to add to the list. He can't help but notice there's something odd about this mud. It has a slickness to it, a purple sheen that reflects the sunlight more than mud really ought to. He's up to his knees in it now. No sword yet. He casts his eyes around, throws up his hands in hopelessness. "Nimue?" he asks. It's worth a shot. Bit of help, maybe? No answer. No pale arm shoots skyward from the oily waters holding aloft a gleaming sword. That only works for Arthur's Caliban, apparently. Not common swords like his that soil themselves with blood now and again. It's made him careless, coming back from the dead. He'd never have walked blithely across a moor in the old days. Suicide. He's used to being pampered now, cars and helicopters and warm...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?